This morning the British ambassador in Berlin handed to the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war existed between our countries. Mr. Chamberlain went on, "I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received and that consequently this country is at war with Germany." One woman had a handkerchief pressed violently to her nose, with tears streaming down her face. Monday, 4th of September, 1939. Today I went down to the town to see the immigration officer about returning to England. Heavens! He told me that I should have to stay in Malaya for the duration of the emergency. No one was being allowed to leave. I returned to the house wondering what I was going to do next. Wednesday, 6th of September, 1939. During the night I had a brilliant idea and in the morning I went to see Mr. Isherwood, the Blue Funnel agent, and without telling him what the immigration officer had told me, asked to be signed on to the next ship back to England. I produced Mr. Holt's letter which duly impressed him and he signed me on without further ado as a deck boy with the Blue Funnel ship Menelaus arriving Penang on 20 September. Armed with his signature, I returned to the immigration officer and told him I was a member of the crew who had got stuck in Penang. This fooled him and he agreed that I could leave Malaya. Wednesday, 20th of September, 1939. At exactly 3 o'clock the Menelaus was docked and I was taken on board by the agent. She is different from the Cyclops in that she can take 16 passengers as well as cargo. I was given a tiny cabin as apparently there is no room for me in the forecastle with the crew. It even has a small fan. The ship is not a very inspiring sight as the crew have begun to camouflage her in a dirty grey paint. My sister and her husband came to see me off. It was a very emotional moment as I had no idea whether I would ever see them again. I walked to the side of the ship and watched them walk along the wharf with their steps breaking the quiet of the night and disappearing in the darkness. The engine of a car started up and it moved off. I was unable to sleep. At 4 o'clock in the morning chains rattled, up came the anchor and the Menelaus began to move out of Penang Harbour. At sea again and heading for home Thursday, 21st of September, 1939. No one seemed to notice me today and I skulked around pretending to be a passenger. It gave me an opportunity to study my fellow passengers. There were 5 of them and we were taking on a further 6 in port set. There was Zims, a rubber planter from Malaya returning to England to volunteer, Blomfield, a schoolmaster from Manila, a very suspicious lady called Mrs. Benyon from Bangkok who claims she is Dutch but I suspect she is German, and 2 schoolboys returning from their holidays to England. Later on Eames and Blomfield became good friends during the day but once they had got down to the alcohol in the evenings fights broke out between them quite regularly. Fortunately they were usually so drunk by then that no damage was done. Friday, 22nd of September, 1939. The idleness of yesterday didn't last long and I was caught today and interviewed by the first mate. He immediately gave me the job of painting the rest of the ship grey. The rest of the passengers were most amused but I was not since I covered myself and most of my cabin with grey paint. Saturday, 23rd of September, 1939. We all listened to the news in the small passenger saloon. The Romanian Prime Minister has been shot by the Nazis. There was a comment by Neville Chamberlain on Hitler's latest speech, "If Herr Hitler says Germany can fight for 7 years, I say Britain and France can fight for 37 years. Apparently there is another war rumor that every second bomb that fell on Warsaw failed to explode and contained a note from the Skoda Works saying, "We are with you, Poles." This might have some truth in it, as I understand the arms factories revolted a few days ago and were crushed with the usual Nazi methods, torturing in cellars, mass murder and whippings. Monday, 25th of September, 1939. The sea has been rather rough since we left Penang and we are caught in the tail end of a southwest monsoon. This morning for the first time since leaving Penang, 2 boats were sighted, One looked like a destroyer in a hurry and the other, a merchant ship, turned about and fled when it saw us. At 9:30 we entered Colombo Harbor, which at first sight looked very ordinary. After much maneuvering we dropped anchor about 30 yards off a jetty and immediately the ship was besieged by officials of all sorts and sizes. Tuesday 26th of September, 1939. We are getting an old gun here in Colombo to protect the ship and I have been told that I will be on the gun crew, but it has not arrived yet. At present we are loading a cargo of tea and rubber. Thursday 28th of September, 1939. The chosen gun crew, myself included, were assembled on deck to go ashore and receive training on our new acquisition, an ancient 1917 Japanese naval gun which had been in store in Colombo ever since the last war. We approached this event with considerable interest and speculation. We were taken ashore and marched into a long shed on the quayside where our gun rested alongside a lot of other rolled firing pieces. We must have been fairly near the head of the queue because our gun looked quite new compared to some of the other junk. I hope it impresses the enemy. A smart naval instructor formed us into a crew and chose me as gun trainer, apparently because I appeared to have two serviceable eyes. My job is to look through a telescopic sight and on instruction turn a wheel until a vertical line on the sight picks up the target and then fine-tune it onto the center, presumably a submarine conning tower. Big job. Key man. After some fairly rudimentary instruction we returned to the ship. Saturday 30th of September, 1939. Just after breakfast orders came through that we were to proceed outside the harbor to test our huge gun with live shells. Out at sea we assembled at our gun which by this time had been firmly bolted onto the poop deck. A large orange crate had been painted bright yellow and was dropped over the side as a target. A shell was loaded into the barrel and at a suitable distance I began to train the gun onto the general area of the target and awaited instructions dash left, more left. Left, more left, steady. I picked up the target and focused the vertical line onto it. Fire. There was an enormous explosion and at the end of my telescopic sight it was like watching the end of the world. Deafened, we peered through the smoke at the box bobbing about on the sea in the distance, in vain. No sight of the shell. We never did see it. In discussion afterwards it appeared that the gun layer had been following the instructions meant for me so by the time we fired the gun, the barrel must have been nearly vertical. At any rate, after another shot we got the hang of it and the final one sent up a plume of spray at least in the general area of the fast disappearing orange box. I only hope we don't have to fire while steaming along in the middle of a convoy. The naval instructor passed us reluctantly as a gun crew and after dropping him off we set sail from Colombo for Port Said. Sunday 1st of October, 1939. We spent all morning filling and sewing up sandbags. The news over the wireless has put the wind up some of the passengers since our dear old friend Hitler has announced that Germany is going to treat all British merchant ships as warships and has given orders that they are to be sunk on sight. Monday 2nd of October, 1939. I cleaned out the shell magazine this morning under the orders of the second mate. After that we all filled sandbags and placed them round the bridge. After lunch there was a gun alert and practice although we fired no more shells. Tuesday 3rd of October, 1939. Continued filling sandbags. Wednesday 4th of October, 1939. Filled and sewed sandbags. Thursday 5th of October, 1939. I am beginning to appreciate what it feels like to be a convict. Friday 6th of October, 1939. We are supposed to have arrived at Aden today but no sight of land. Speculation among the passengers as to whether we are to go round the Cape or not. Saturday 7th of October, 1939. During the night we arrived in Aden. At 6 o'clock I looked out of the porthole into the red glow at the land about 1/2 mile away. It looked rugged and sun-baked silhouetted against the morning sky, hard and desolate. We had dropped anchor and a faint breeze stirred the blue water, As the sun rose higher and higher, the heat became more and more suffocating. The hills descended abruptly to the sea and coursed around the bay to a desert-like plateau on the other side. The town was situated on this slope and looked very uninteresting. To our right there was just barren rock hundreds of feet high without any sign of vegetation or life. Shortly after breakfast a coal barge came alongside and we took on coal. Planks were pushed up from the barge to the deck and coolies carried baskets of coal on their heads running up the planks with bare feet to tip their loads into the bunkers. After taking on coal, the anchor came up and we headed towards the Red Sea and not the Cape route, thank heavens. Monday 9th of October, 1939. This morning we had more gun practice and the gun crew were also instructed in rifle shooting at a tin which had been attached to a string at the end of the poop. This is in case we have to shoot and set off mines which we might encounter around England. Thursday 12th of October, 1939. I woke up in Portishead. This afternoon I surprised everyone including the captain by diving off his bridge into the harbour. A height of about 40 feet. I didn't think this so funny afterwards as one of the passengers had said he had seen a shark cruising round the ship. Sunday 15th of October, 1939. I am feeling fed up and bored with Portishead. However, 5 or 6 more passengers are expected on board before we leave. Wednesday 18th of October, 1939. Thank God we are at sea again and people's nerves have calmed down. I now have to take watch. I was on watch this morning up the main mast from 10 until 12 and then transferred to the poop for the afternoon and evening watch. Thursday 19th of October, 1939. I am tired this morning. I am on watch again in the morning, afternoon, and evening. These periods consist of 2 hours on watch but you are then on 2 hours standby beforehand so it is a long day and night. Saturday 21st of October, 1939. The watches have now been changed to 4 hours with 2 hours on standby, so tonight I got 3 hours sleep in all. You have a hand rattle so if you see anything you can alert the bridge. Tuesday 24th of October, 1939. I was up at 3:30 this morning and on watch and, Christ, it is getting cold. I painted the raft all morning and hope we don't have to use it. I was on watch again in the afternoon and night and it's beginning to look like a 12-hour day. Wednesday 25th of October, 1939. Fed up and it's nothing but work. There is a strong wind and the ship is rolling. At the moment my day is as follows: 3:30 a.m. called by the seaman on standby, 4 to 5 a.m. watch on the top of the bridge, 5 to 6 a.m. watch on the main mast, 6 to 7:30 a.m. swab decks, 7:30 to 8 a.m. standby, 8 to 10 a.m. bath, breakfast and stand down. 10 to 12 noon work on the deck, 12 to 3:45 p.m. lunch and stand down, 3:45 p.m. tea, 4 to 6 p.m. watch on the main mast, 6 to 10 p.m. standby with the rattle on deck, 10 p.m. bed, and sure people complain about a 48-hour week. Christ, they're lucky. It's getting colder and colder. The ship has run out of cigarettes because apparently we were due in London 3 weeks ago, so I am smoking a pipe and a disgusting mixture of some stuff called bulwark and the few Will's Woodbines I have left over and it is all quite sickening. I must replenish cigarettes in Gibraltar if we get there. The crew are all making their own and even the passengers are beginning to run out. Friday 27th of October, 1939. The reality of the situation and war is gradually beginning to dawn on me. In Portishead we were formed into a convoy of about 40 ships of various nationalities. I wonder if this is the first big convoy of the war, and I don't think some of them understand the orders. The whole convoy is supposed to turn so many degrees at a certain time and a lot of ships either don't turn on time or turn at the wrong time. This is all right in the daytime when you can see them but it is very hazardous at night. This morning the first mate assembled the whole watch crew and stressed upon us that the safety of the ship depended on the sharp eyes of the watch. The long hours and the strain of searching out at night is beginning to tell on me. There is a hell of a wind and it is getting colder and colder. The sea is rough and the ship just behind us is shipping water like nobody's business. Saturday, 28th of October, 1939. We arrived in Gibraltar. Sunday, 29th of October, 1939. We steamed out of Gibraltar at noon and there is a change of watch. I am on from 12 until 2 standby and then on watch 12 until 4 morning and night. I spent my standby as usual in the able seaman's mess drinking tea. It was a raw night and I had no desire to sit around outside. Unfortunately, the ABS quarters are swarming with beetles of all sorts and sizes. They are all very familiar and crawl about unmolested as though they own the place. The sailors call them Singapore Joes. I went on watch in blinding rain. Luckily, one of the able seamen had lent me his oilskin so I didn't get too wet. After some hot cocoa I retired to bed at 4:30 in the morning with the thought that I would be called again in a couple of hours for swabbing the decks. Tuesday, 31st of October, 1939. At 4 o'clock this afternoon we passed Cape St. Vincent. The wind rose steadily during the afternoon and since I am now on watch in the afternoon on top of the bridge I got the full fury of it. Wednesday, 1st of November, 1939. The 12 until 4 night watch is a loathsome business and I find it very difficult getting used to rising in the middle of the night. The ABS are a very decent lot and Joe, my watchmate, always hands over his oilskins on the completion of his watch. We have arranged it so that he goes on watch first while I am on standby and vice versa. The weather is finer today with odd patches of blue sky and there has been plenty of moon for keeping a good eye out on the convoy. There have been several near misses with ships turning at the wrong time but so far no collisions, touch wood. 1. Braggett, West Hartlepool, the house in which I was born. 2. My four brothers at Bamberg Castle, which my parents took each summer for our holidays. 3. My mother with Terence, Dick, Rupert and John. 4. Wellington College Swimming 8, 1937. PH seated on the left of Charlie Stockton, the master in charge of swimming. 5. Chick pilots in their new feathers, 1940. PH Center 6. Blue Funnel TSS Menelaus on which I returned from Penang, September, 1939. Saturday, 4th of November, 1939. What a night. Gales and blinding rain with huge seas breaking over the ship. It was quite impossible to climb the main mast so I went on watch on top of the bridge. I was deafened by the roar of wind and sea with the bows heaving up and down and spray sweeping over the bridge. It was all I could do to hang on, pray, and never mind the watchkeeping. The cold seeped through my oilskins to such an extent that it was impossible to sleep when I came off watch and everything in my cabin was scattered around the floor. Sunday, 5th of November, 1939. As we approached England there is so much going on around the convoy that I have decided to stop my diary as the information in it might prove of use to the enemy if we were sunk and I was picked up. All I can say is that we have lost one ship in an accident and an escort has sunk a German submarine, so there has been a lot of excitement. Thursday, 9th of November, 1939. We are now in the Thames estuary so I can start my diary again. I am longing to get ashore to enjoy a square meal. We are 3 weeks late and for the last week we have been living on bully beef and ship's biscuits. The blackout has got on everyone's nerves. We docked at Tilbury and were at once invaded by immigration officers and security men. The security men immediately homed in on Mrs. Bennion and took her off protesting. I gather her passport contained German and Russian stamps and they had found an unlicensed revolver in her cabin. As for me, I am in even worse trouble. An officious immigration officer informed me that the Merchant Navy was now a restricted occupation, and as I was signed on the ship as a crew member, I was in the Merchant Navy for the duration of the war. This was terrible news and didn't fit my plans at all. So I went back to my small cabin, sat down and thought out my next move. Later on I went and saw the first mate and asked if I could have shore leave for the night. He said yes and wrote out a slip of paper for me to give to the dockyard police saying that I was to return later this evening. So I left all my gear in the cabin and went down the gangplank. The dockyard policeman looked at my chit and waved me on, and I turned back towards the Menelaus and said a silent goodbye. I had learned a lot from my time at sea, most of all how to get on in all kinds of company. I had aged at least 2 years in 6 months and my body was fit and hard. I had come down to the level of the ordinary crewman and understood his simple virtues. I had learned to talk with crowds. To walk with kings would come later. I was now a deserter from the Merchant Navy. 4. The Royal Air Force. On leaving this austere room, I was faced by a corridor cluttered with military paraphernalia, from a large wooden propeller attached to the wall to old photographs of military courses I had attended and pictures of ancient aeroplanes. My diary continues, November 1939. I hurried to London, where I lunched with my brother John, now a territorial captain in the Northumberland Fusiliers. I am supposed to be drowned. My family thought I was on the Yorkshire, which was sunk in the Bay of Biscay. When I had written that I was coming home on the Menelaus, the censor had blacked it out and, as the Yorkshire was sailing from Malaya at the time, they had assumed that she was my ship. John told me that Terence had enlisted in the Fleet Air Arm as a pilot. I found my hatred of him had already receded in the process of growing up. After lunch I caught the train to Newcastle upon Tyne and holed up in John's now empty flat while I pondered what to do in the future. Wellington has put me off the army completely. I can hardly join the Royal Navy as a deserter from the Merchant Navy, and my only other option appears to be the Royal Air Force. I rather fancy myself as a latter-day biggies, so I wrote off to the RAF recruiting office offering my services as a volunteer aircrew. After a few days I received a reply to the effect that the RAF were not taking volunteers at the moment, but suggesting that I keep in touch with them monthly. As I hourly expect a policeman to knock on the door and arrest me as a deserter, it is imperative that I move out of John's flat and find a temporary job elsewhere. January, 1940. I read in an advertisement that preparatory schools wanted temporary masters to replace those called up for the forces. I registered with an agency called Gabbiters and Thring, and the jobs began to arrive. On 8 January I went down to Portsmouth for an interview with a Mr. Foster, the headmaster of Stubbington House, the preparatory school for Dartmouth which had been evacuated for the Waterloos. He offered me a post at the princely sum of £100 per annum. I explained to Mr. Foster that I was only waiting to join the RAF and would have to leave at short notice when called up. So, suitably attired as a schoolmaster in a Harris tweed jacket and dark grey flannels, I duly presented myself at Stubbington. As so many of the able-bodied masters have already left for the war, one find that not only am I required to take the boys in all games and physical training, but also teach 20 hours a week of history, geography and mathematics to the bottom form, about my mark. There are around 100 boys in the school and it really is great fun. An extension of Wellington, except that I have 100 fags instead of 5. I am becoming increasingly impatient to get into uniform, particularly as I dread the thought that the press gang will catch up with me and I could be returned in irons to the Merchant Navy. I have been pestering the nearest RAF recruiting office at Brighton at least once a week, but meanwhile I have joined the local unit of the Home Guard. Here my diary ended. The storm breaks. History has called the period from August, 1939, to May, 1940, the Phoney War. The antagonists were dug in behind their concrete defences, the Maginot and Siegfried lines, the French and English complacent in their static positions, The Germans building up their strength and waiting to unleash their mobile thrusts into the Low Countries. I had just returned for my second term at Stubbington House when the storm broke. First to go was Denmark, then Norway. In May the Germans launched their blitzkrieg on the Low Countries, with a right hook outflanking the Maginot Line and followed swiftly by a full frontal attack. The Allied front disintegrated and the German army swept the British Expeditionary Force back to Dunkirk, from where it was finally evacuated at the beginning of June. During the Battle for France, the RAF had lost over 1,000 aircraft in the air and on the ground, and it was this disaster that at last opened the floodgates for recruits with the great and hurried expansion of the Royal Air Force, just prior to the commencement of the Battle of Britain in mid-August. From now until the final defeat of Germany in 1945, a war would rage in the air upon which our whole future depended. It would stretch the capacities of both sides to their limits, playing a decisive part in the final outcome of the war as a whole. The experiences of the next 5 years, during which I would play my own small part in that great conflict, would leave an indelible mark on my character and, indeed, upon my whole future. So this is perhaps the time at which to take a brief look at the broad pattern of that air war and the terrible price that the RAF would pay in men and aircraft. The Battle of Germany. Casualties in the Battle of Britain were quite modest, 435 pilots lost on operations, compared to the huge casualties suffered during the Battle of Germany. That great aerial conflict, the like of which the world had never seen before nor was likely to see again, was waged relentlessly for 3 long years, day and night. The score would reach a crescendo in 1942 with an armada of 1,000 aircraft over Cologne. It only ended when Germany, reeling like a fatally wounded bull, finally sank to her knees and gave up. The Battle of Germany was a long and enormously costly battle in men and aircraft. Night after night, scores of aircraft fell into the cauldron of fire and steel over Germany, with tales of exceptional courage and cowardice remaining untold. The remainder of the force crept home in the cold light of dawn to regroup and lick their wounds, while the liberators and flying fortresses of the American Air Force circled East Anglia in the early morning like flocks of wild geese in a thermal, wheeling and maneuvering into huge formations before setting course to face the same perils. In this aerial battle, RAF losses alone in aircrew were over 47,000, and on the worst night of the campaign 94 aircraft were lost over Nuremberg, 11.8% of the force. Statistically, the average lifespan of a crew in bomber command was about 3 months, somewhat better than that of a subaltern in the trenches of the First World War, but still not much to look forward to. It must also be remembered that most of these were officer aircrew of the highest caliber, men whom the country could ill afford to lose. Before the introduction of long-range escort fighters, the American 8th Air Force took a most terrible hammering in the daylight raids. Without the tenacity, determination and single-mindedness of one man, Bomber Harris, the awful loss in life and material could well have called a halt to the campaign. Harris believed completely that the bomber offensive could by itself win the war, but he was wrong. However, the Battle of Germany merits a place among the greatest battles of our history, but has never received it. Even worse, he suffered sinister denigration after the war by left-wing administrations and critics. It may not have won the war, but this great campaign had to be fought, and the war could not have been won without it. It so weakened the enemy's military machine and resolve that the invasion of Europe became a reality and finally a success. There can be no record of how many more submarines, bombers, tanks, V-1s and V-2s the Germans could have produced had they not been forced to divert resources into research and development, manpower and technical capacity into the production of defensive weapons against the bombers. Dismissing the armchair strategists mesmerized by statistics, what better authority than Speer himself, German Minister of Armaments and War Production, who had little doubt of the effects that strategic bombing had on the situation on the Russian front, the Allied invasion and reduction in the German offensives. Aircrew cadet. At long last I was instructed to report to the aircrew reception center at Uxbridge on 26 July, 1940, and the period of waiting was over. After the hard struggle to get accepted, my entry into the Royal Air Force was bewilderingly easy. The scene on arrival at RAF Uxbridge was like Paddington Station at the height of the rush hour, packed to overflowing with young men clutching documents, hurrying from one important point to another in the machinery of processing recruits.